Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Today on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with Michael DeShane. He is the president of Cross Insurance Employee Benefits. He's going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act, what's happening currently, and why it affects you each and every day. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today, we're talking with Michael DeShane. He is the president of Cross Insurance's Employee Benefits. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, David. I'm happy to be here.
Good. Hey, you know what? You guys have been growing and growing and growing. Tell me a little about where Cross is today.
Well, actually, Cross is a family-owned company, still owned by family members, Woodrow and Royce Cross. The interesting thing about Woodrow Cross, he's 98 years old. He'll go to work every day. He'll work from 7:30 to 5. And the office opens at 8 and closes at 4:30. So he's there to watch you and make sure you're there.
Well, you know, it's good to have somebody from the family so dedicated, right?
Absolutely. He's an inspiration.
From a standpoint of customer service and delivering to the client, I know the motto is there. Tell me a little about what differentiates you now today than ever before.
Well, first of all, we're much larger than we've ever been. We have over 700 employees. But I think that if you go back to the roots of the organization, the company was started in 1954, very, very deeply committed to customer service. And so Cross will service a small client in, you know, similar fashion that they'll service a large client. And so every client is important. If we accept their money, then we've got an obligation to make sure that we deliver and deliver what at the level of their expectations.
So you're part of the employee benefits division, or that part of it. Full service? Is there anything you don't do?
No, not that I can think of.
Oh, that's great. So tell me a little bit about, we're going to be talking today about the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
I'd like to go back a little bit.
Okay.
Tell me a little about where we've been, just to get people up to speed. I'm sure that we all know it's been here since 2010. Right. But tell me about where we are, how we got to where we are, what we're doing today about it, and if there's some future stuff we need to think about, then we'll dig into the details.
Well, we're sort of at a critical point of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it did. The law was passed in 2010. Many of the provisions of the Act went into effect in September of 2010, but it's been slowly rolling out ever since then. And one of the things that has, I think, impacted, you know, businesses in terms of their attitude about the Affordable Care Act is that there have been a lot of delays and changes. And so I think that that's created a little bit of confusion, you know, in the marketplace. And so employers are expecting that, you know, things will continue to change and possibly be delayed. As a matter of fact, the U.S. House passed a resolution to delay the expansion of the small group rating plan to 99. And so that's been delayed in the House. We're going to wait and see what happens in the Senate. And then we'll see what the president does. And so even at this stage, we're still looking at changes that could have a significant impact on businesses and what they have to do in order to be in compliance with the law. 2014, 2015, and 2016 are pivotal years for the Affordable Care Act. This is when the individual and the employer mandate go into effect. All of this was supposed to go into effect in 2014. However, some of it has been delayed. The individual mandate went into effect in 2014. The employer mandate was actually delayed until 2015, and actually even some businesses are being delayed until 2016, depending on the size of your business. And so there are a lot of moving parts. It's an extremely complex law. Probably, in my mind, is as complex or more complex than our tax code. And so there are provisions that make this extremely difficult to be sure that you're in compliance. And so I think that's the biggest challenge today, is making sure you're in compliance.
Well, you know, and they continue to make new regulations and rules, correct?
Constantly.
They're coming out with new things. And that even makes it
more uncomfortable for businesses. You know, when we talk to companies, we talk to businesses, they'll say simple things like, you know what, if we just know the rules, we'll comply. But when you keep changing the rules every year and you keep making different changes, it's hard sometimes to understand that.
Correct. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the law has yet to be defined. You know, we deal with the complexities of the law to the point of where sometimes, you know, we need to reach out to attorneys to try to get their opinion on what they feel what the law means. And I've talked with some attorneys that actually would prefer not to be involved with the Affordable Care Act, only because much of it has yet to be defined. You know, they deal with aspects of the law that they understand because it's been defined. Much of the Affordable Care Act is still up in the air.
That's incredible when you really think about it. Imagine running your business not knowing anything about, you know, having all the rules and regulations. It is hard to believe sometimes.
Yeah, imagine going to work every morning with that over
yeah.
your head.
Yeah, it really yeah. doesn't seem yeah. to make a lot of sense. So today we're going to make up some rules, and tomorrow you'll know what you're going to do, right?
Let's hope we're doing the right thing.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I certainly understand the premise behind it. I think we all do and understand the premise. But from an employer standpoint, it makes it very difficult for planning, for budgeting, for, you know, making sure that they really understand what's going to happen.
Precisely. Yeah.
So, I'm going to break this up into two groups just to complete our thoughts here, one being the small businesses okay. and then one being the large businesses, if we could. So there, let's start with the small. Where are we at in terms of small business rate coverage, you know, coverages that are out there? I know that there are a lot of changes happening coming up in 2016.
Okay, well, I think the first thing we need to do is define exactly what small business is. The definition of a small business in the eyes of the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, is basically businesses with fewer than 50 full-time equivalents. And that becomes a point of, you know, some difficulty for businesses. And you know, what exactly does that mean, 50 full-time equivalents? And so you need to look at your so-called full-time employees, and the feds have defined full-time as 30 hours, whereas employers historically have looked at 40 hours as full-time. Well, that rule has changed. And so now you have to count your full-timers, which is down to 30 hours. And then you have to count all of your part-time employees, add them up, divide by 120 hours a month, and that'll give you the full-time equivalent of those part-time employees. And so when you add the full-timers and the full-time equivalent number of the part-timers, if you're over 50, then in the eyes of the ACA, you're a large employer. Large employers are faced with the employer responsibility, the employer mandate, if you will, which basically suggests that you either participate in offering insurance to employees or you don't.
You know, I just want to back up for a second, because if you don't mind. So does equivalent include interns? Does it include contractors? Just want to throw out a couple more things to make people think
about.
Dave,
I think you're really hitting on a very, very important point here, because that's where there's a tremendous amount of confusion. You know, exactly who is an employee? Well, an employee is a common law employee, and if that person is under the direction of the employer, then chances are they're going to be an employee of that business. We run into problems when companies lease employees. We have a client, for example, that actually they employ work release folks from the prisons. And so the question is, are they employees? Well, if they're receiving a paycheck and a W-2 from that employer, that is an employee. And so this is where some of the confusion comes into.
Sure.
It makes it difficult for businesses. And so in terms of exactly what are we counting, who are we counting, how are we counting them, you know, becomes a critical point in all of this, because failure to put yourself in the proper category can result in some fairly serious penalties for the employer. And, you know, our job is to do everything we can to help employers stay out of trouble. And so this is some of the difficulty that we're running into right now. And much of this, once again, is undefined.
We're talking with Michael Deschanes, president of Cross Insurance Employees Benefits. So you were talking about large group. Obviously, I get you off track there for a second. But so talk again about large group versus
okay.
small.
Okay, so the large group definition would obviously be those businesses that have 50 or more full-time equivalents. Now, there are different rules. And so what we're dealing with right now is a provision of the law that would expand the definition of small employer to 99. However, the ACA isn't going to change the definition of what a large employer is. And so the expansion of the small group to 99 is basically for rating purposes. However, for ACA purposes, the feds will still be looking at the definition of 50 full-time equivalents. And so really the expansion is a matter of how these plants are rated. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, Congress is dealing with the possibility of allowing states to delay the rating provision of the law. You know, that we will know soon.
Okay, so we have the two groups, small and large groups. We have, you know, the individual mandate. We have the employer mandate. Tell me, what are some things right now today that if I'm an employer that I need to look at for 216 for change?
Well, one of the one of the issues obviously is the expansion of the rating, you know, for those mid-sized groups, and so we will, you know, have to deal with that depending on what the outcome, you know, will be here. The other important component is actually a reporting requirement for businesses that are, and the term that's used for determining whether an employer has to comply with the ACA or not is whether or not you're an applicable large employer. And applicable large employers are those businesses with 50 or more full-time equivalents. Well, an applicable large employer, in addition to having to offer coverage to employees, will also have to file reports with the federal government and provide statements to employees. That's a fairly onerous obligation that employers will have to abide by. So much so that, you know, with the complexities of determining who and what the employees are working for the firm, it's really not something that can be done on a manual basis. So systems really need to be in place in order to properly categorize employees over the course of the year, because you'll be reporting on these employees at the end of the year. And so the first reporting deadline will be in the first part of 2016, and that'll be for 2015. Now let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
So you know, businesses of you know, over 50 full-time equivalents will have to file. Businesses that are fully insured will have to file. Businesses that are self-funded will have to file. Businesses that don't offer coverage to their employees will have to file. And so that is something that, you know, I can sort of scratch my head about, you know, how are they going to know that they need to do this? And so they're not offering coverage to the employees now. And
that's
so
right.
They're going to have to file these reports and provide employee notices of the fact that they're not offering coverage to employees. And so that's an often overlooked you know, item for businesses, because
so it doesn't matter the size of the organization, or does it?
Over 50.
Over
50 full-time equivalents. Those businesses with fewer than 50 full-time equivalents won't be obligated to do that. You know, there are some exceptions. So if one exception would be if a small business is self-funded, then they'll have to file the reports. But in generally speaking, it'll be for businesses of 50 or more full-time.
So let's talk about that self-funding for just a second, because we're seeing more and more businesses talk about doing this, creating groups and trying to self-fund.
Yeah, there's going to be activity. There's going to be more activity in the area of self-funding for a number of reasons. First of all, some of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act don't apply to self-funded plans. And the biggest item there is the insurer tax that is assessed. So that could be 3-4% of a business's premium that they can save. Also, if the expansion of a small group, you know, does move to 99 employees, then businesses may find that they will be able to lower their costs by moving to a self-funded arrangement. So we would fully expect to see, you know, much more activity in the 50 to 99 market segment in the event that that is done. It's self-funding has always been an option for businesses, and it's an option that is good. It's a good option. However, it's not an option that necessarily suits every business out there. It's something that I think businesses have to, you know, to review quite carefully. And one element of that is the tolerance for risk. And so if a business really has low tolerance for risk, moving to a self-funded environment probably isn't a good idea.
Age factor? Is that part of being self-funded, or
I'm
just asking some of the other factors involved?
It could be. It's, you know, obviously, you know, the older you are, the more likely you'll need, you know, more sophisticated medical treatment or care. You know, when you're younger, it's the weekend warrior syndrome, you know, that really gets you into trouble.
Well, how about from pregnancy and other things? Those can be expensive.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of
a premature delivery can be one of the most expensive claims that a business would incur. And these are some of the factors to think about. You know, a hemophiliac case, it can run hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so when you hire somebody, you don't necessarily know whether the employee or their dependents, you know, bring in, you know, some of these medical situations with them. And so the smaller you are, the higher the risk, you know, for being hit with a large claim.
You seeing groups more coming together, like a type of industries or different things?
There's some activity in that area. There's the phenomenon of we're seeing much more captive activity, captives being developed, where businesses will sort of come together to share, you know, risk. Once again, I think that an informed purchaser, you know, really needs to look at that very carefully before deciding to move in that direction, because that could have dire consequences as well. So, you know, anytime you take on more risk, then the amount of due diligence that an employer needs to take, you know, increases.
Well, there's no question that when we're talking about the Affordable Care Act and what we need to do, we need to have good partners in our life in terms of understanding who we can talk to and what we can believe. And have trusted advisors in this area. And we're going to talk about that when we get back. We're talking with Michael Duchesne, President of Cross Insurance Employee Benefits. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAKorea.com. And today we're talking with Michael Duchesne. He's the president of Cross Insurance's Employee Benefits. Michael, you know, we are going to be talking about in a few minutes about trusted partners, because we talked about it when we left the show. But I wanted to talk about something that you mentioned during the break. And that's about the individual mandates. So why don't you provide a little bit more information on the individual mandate part versus the employer mandate, which we already covered pretty well.
Okay. Well, the important thing to keep in mind here is that the Affordable Care Act actually touches pretty much everybody in the country. And so if you're an employer, then you're dealing with some of the plan design requirements of the law, particularly in the under 50 market. If you're a large employer, you're dealing with the pay-or-play or shared responsibility portion of the law that requires an employer offer coverage to employees. But if you're an individual, the Affordable Care Act also impacts you directly. So the law essentially requires that we all be covered in some fashion. And in the absence of being covered by a government program, Medicare, Medicaid, a CHIP program, or an employer-sponsored plan, then we have an obligation actually to go out and purchase coverage on our own. And failure to do so, unless you find yourself in an accepted situation or class, will subject you to possible fines. And the fines were in the beginning sort of ill-defined and appeared to be quite benign. In the first year, as an individual, if you didn't have coverage, the fine was $95 on 1% of adjusted household income. Well, in the early stages of the law, we didn't know what the 1% meant. Well, it was finally determined as to what that 1% could go up to. So for an individual, the fine could be as high as $2,448 in 2014. And many people were finding, you know, that they were falling in a situation where they were fined far greater than the $95, because that's when the 1% came in, and it is a greater of the two. For a family of five, it could be as high as $12,240. And so the fine associated with non-compliance with the Affordable Care Act as an individual, could be quite damaging to a family. And so, being aware of that is obviously very, very important. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, there are some exceptions to the fine. However, it's important that people understand exactly what those exceptions are in order to avoid the fine. One more aspect about that I'd like to clarify is that because of the requirement now that we have coverage as individuals, we're finding that employees that have historically refused to participate in an employer-sponsored plan are now coming forward. And so they're looking for coverage, through an employer. And so in some instances we've seen growth in employer-sponsored plans because of the individual mandate. One other aspect of the individual mandate that I think could have an impact on employers is if an employer is offering coverage. Now, this is regardless of size, and whether it's small employer, large employer, applicable large employer, or what have you. The individual could be precluded from receiving a subsidy at the exchange because if the plan is provides minimum value and it's affordable to the employee, then that employee is prohibited from receiving a subsidy in the public exchange. And so some employers, particularly in the small group market, are questioning whether or not it continues to be a sound decision to offer coverage to their employees, because in some instances they may be preventing their employees from actually receiving subsidy in the public exchange, which may be greater than the employer contribution that is being made, which is also a form of subsidy.
So when an employer makes that decision and they say it's probably better it's in your best interest to actually go to the exchange rather than for me as an employer to provide you insurance, and they say we'll give you X amount of dollars to do that, how does that decision get made, and is there a minimum amount they have to pay and to make that actually work?
Well, in order for the plan to be considered appropriate coverage, there is a threshold that the employer has to pay. So obviously that, that's a consideration. In terms of the decision to discontinue their employer sponsored plan, it's not quite as simple as many would think. First of all, not everybody will qualify for a subsidy in an employment situation, and so obviously this would benefit those individuals that would qualify for subsidy. And by the way, the subsidy threshold is 100% to 400% of the federal poverty limit. So anybody above 400% of the federal poverty limit, wouldn't qualify for a subsidy at the exchange. And so we'll have, employees that will be above that 400% poverty level. And in the state of Maine, we have the reverse problem of anybody below 100% of the federal poverty limit won't qualify for a subsidy at the exchange. And also, if they're a childless adult, you may not be eligible for Medicaid. And so we have had situations where individuals have fallen through the cracks when the decision is made to discontinue the group plan. So it's not a decision that could be made lightly. As with most things, there's a little bit of homework that has to be done. An employer really needs to look at his or her workforce, to make the right decision in order to achieve the greatest outcome for the employees.
You brought it up in the last session. You talked about leasing employees using PEOs. Talk about that and whether or not that can have an impact on an organization or not.
Right. There's a perception that if an employer is using leased employees, that the ACA problem is not their problem. It's the lease organization, the PEO, what have you. That isn't always the case. So it really depends on what's happening at the PEO level or the employee leasing level to determine whether or not that employer is immune from having to offer coverage to those leased employees. And there are parameters that have to be met in order for that to occur. And so there isn't an automatic default for employers that are using leased employees or are participating in the PEO. There are rules that need to be abided by in order for that employee to be exempt from the requirements of the ACA.
So it's not as simple as it sounds.
It isn't.
And of course, it never is.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Which is why we are going to get to the point of a trusted advisor relationship with an organization. People certainly have insurance brokers, CPAs, attorneys that they use. I know in terms of my business, I sometimes pull together a council of trusted advisors. I do. I have a meeting with, typically bring in the key players, business coach, advisors that we bring together probably once a year. Probably should do it more, but I don't. At this particular point, I bring that in. Why is it so important for companies to really lean on these trusted advisors even more today, especially in regards to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think the one point that that sort of drives that home is that the Affordable Care Act, you know, isn't being governed by necessarily just one federal agency. There are a number of federal agencies that are involved with the Affordable Care Act. There's the IRS, the Department of Labor, there's the Department of Homeland Security, and so on and so forth. There are many federal agencies that are involved with establishing rules and regulations for the Affordable Care Act, and so that really touches upon different areas of expertise. In our practice, you know, certainly we can provide a fair amount of advice and counsel to our clients. However, there is a limit to what we can do. And in some instances, you know, we really need to bring in the experts that are really involved with some of these other federal agencies. And I'm really talking about CPAs and quite often, you know, ERISA attorneys. Because as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the Affordable Care Act is yet to be defined, and so it's really left to interpretation, and the interpretation really needs to go to those areas of specialty where employers, you know, will be given, you know, proper advice and counsel. Here's an example. The Affordable Care Act requires that commonly owned business or aggregated businesses be viewed as one business. While that might sound like it's a simple matter, in some instances it can become quite complicated. And having a CPA work with an employer to make that final determination is vital. Because oftentimes, separate tax IDs don't necessarily separate the obligation, you know, for multiple businesses to have to comply with the Affordable Care Act. So if there's a common ownership, or if there's business aggregation, you know, ownerships in some fashion, then we really need to bring in people from the outside. And it goes beyond your insurance broker at that point in time. You know, the CPAs and the attorneys are a very, very valuable part of the team that needs to be assembled. And then we mentioned tracking and employer reporting. In the early stages of this, it was sort of up in the air as to who really would be take on the responsibility of doing all this. And so as time passed, the payroll companies began to emerge as a logical source to provide assistance to employers. And so now the payroll companies are a vital partner in this whole discussion, because they'll generally have the information that is needed in order to file the reports. And so these most payroll companies are developing systems to do the proper tracking, and it can get pretty complicated. However, while the systems are in place, the payroll companies will also need, you know, brokers, attorneys, and CPAs to also help with the guidance to make sure that it's being done properly.
Will the insurance broker in this particular case help model this out for the organization or the company and help provide them a what you would call a blueprint as to what needs to be done?
Yeah, we can review the where businesses stand with regard to the compliance aspect of it, and certainly we can develop a roadmap that will help employers make sure that they get to where they need to be in order to avoid the penalties, because the penalties can be quite severe. So for a business of 130 employees, I mean the there are different penalties to the law. But the penalty could be up to $200,000, and that penalty is not a tax deductible business expense. And so when you look at a for-profit enterprise, the impact of the bottom line is really twice that amount. And so that would have devastating consequences to businesses, you know, should they fall out of compliance with the law. And that's why I think it's vital for, you know, the team to be brought together to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, and in assuring the employer that they're doing the right thing.
Well, I think that's now become more evident than ever, right, in terms of making sure that organizations are set up so they don't fail and so they don't have unintended consequences, which is what we're talking about, something that you know, whenever I talk to businesses, a lot of them say, I just want to go out and make a widget. I just want to go out and make a shirt. That's what I really love to do, Dave, right? That's my dream. That's why I didn't really sign up for 10,000 pieces of regulations and forms and dialogue. I recognize it's important, but it's getting crazy. And so a lot of times they just want to know, hey, where can I go one-stop shop to at least get how to and what to by a trusted advisor. And then I'll bring my partners, my attorneys, my CPAs. And that's what we're talking about today.
Yes. The one fact, though, that's important for business to be clear on is that you're no longer in a position of just being able to run your business. We are now under the obligation to make sure that our business is run with the idea that this is a law we need to comply with. And so it will require businesses to step outside of what they normally do in running their business to ensure that they're going to be okay when it comes to adhering to the requirements of the law. Otherwise, the penalties or the consequences are so severe that not paying attention, could be extremely costly to a business. So much like we'd want to just, make our shirts and, build our homes and, whatever our business is, this is something that we can't ignore.
Well, we talk a lot about that on the HR side, and we've talked about it on the show. You still have to make sure your employee files are right and that the employee paperwork is done correctly and that you're disciplining properly and you have an employee handbook. This is just one more piece, albeit a large piece, of a new puzzle that needs to be figured out by employers today.
Correct. Documentation has always been a vital part of HR. It's become even more vital. And so documentation from the standpoint of documenting that employees have been offered coverage. And the most important documentation now of your workforce is basically what's happening every hour of the workday with that individual. Because the law requires that you track time that is worked and paid for. But the law also requires that you track time that is not worked and you're paid for, such as disability, sick leave, jury duty. And so the tracking obligation goes far beyond just the normal workday. And this is an aspect of the systems that need to be set up in order to be accurate in your reporting and tracking.
We're talking with Mike DeShane. He is the president of Cross Insurance Employee Benefits. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're having the great pleasure of having Mike DeShane, president of Cross Insurance Employee Benefits. Mike, again, thank you for being on the show today.
It's great to be here. I appreciate
We're talking about something very important, and it's funny. We've talked about the Affordable Care Act on the show multiple times, but we are at a critical juncture with the Affordable Care Act. We are in a critical place in terms of organizations being compliant, individuals being compliant, just overall compliance overall. Even though there's more coming, it's a critical point, and we've been talking about it today. I'd like to try to drill down a little bit, if I could, because obviously – you do this every day. God bless you. You do this every day. You talk about it every day. Let's simplify this. What does it take today for a large organization, over 50 full-time equivalents, to be compliant? What does success look like?
Okay. Well, first of all, the important thing to keep in mind is that the law, and this is, I think, a point of confusion with a lot of people. The law doesn't force large employers to offer health insurance. They can choose not to offer health insurance. But if they don't, then they will be subject to what is referred to as the A penalty under the pay or play shared responsibility portion of the law. And so, you know, to define that, basically it's $2,000 for each full-time employee over the course of the year. However, most employers are finding that they're not avoiding, large employers aren't necessarily avoiding the requirement to provide health insurance. I think most large employers want to offer health insurance to their employees.
Sure, it's a hiring benefit.
Absolutely.
And employees still expect it.
Exactly, right. And so we're not seeing a lot of large employers really run away from this. I mean, so we're seeing large employers, you know, embrace the fact that they have to abide by the law. And offer coverage to their full-time employees, which once again is defined as 30 hours as opposed to what might have been used previously. So the important thing here to keep in mind to avoid the severe penalty is that employers must offer coverage to their employees, to their full-time employees. And the key to it is a substantially all threshold that the federal government has defined. And the substantially all threshold is 95% of full-time employees need to be offered coverage. However, in the for 2015, the 95% substantially all threshold was relaxed to 70% for 2015, but only for 2015. And so once we get to 2016, we're back to the 95% substantially all threshold. The law requires that you provide coverage to employees as well as their dependents. And the feds define dependents as children. So we do have situations where a spouse isn't defined as a dependent. The decision is being made to not offer coverage to a spouse. And there may be, you know, good reason to do that, or there may not. It depends on the individual circumstance of the business. Now, the substantially all requirement is very, very important. And this is probably the one aspect of the Affordable Care Act that does keep me awake at night, many nights. Because for an employer to fail to offer coverage to substantially all their full-time employees, they will be viewed as an employer that is not offering coverage to employees. And so this could be a double jeopardy situation for businesses doing that. And so making certain that you meet the 95% threshold is vital. So, for example, if a business has been offering coverage to the employees, paying a substantial sum of money in the form of employer contribution towards the cost of the health insurance, and then they fall below the 95% threshold, they will be assessed the A penalty of the law. So they'll be treated in the same fashion as a business that is not offering coverage to employees. And so we want to avoid that at all costs. So understanding that part of it is vital. And the 95% really is to allow a little bit of a fudge factor for businesses because the target is really 100%. Because over the course of the year, it's likely that we'll misclassify an employee or two. And when we do that, that'll cut into the 5% cushion that we have. And so really our advice to clients is really to shoot for the 100%. Knowing that we may make a few mistakes over the course of the year. And so misclassifying an employee, could put an employer in a situation of where, they could run into problems. And speaking of classifying employees, this is also an important aspect of the law where employers have to properly classify employees. So if an employee has historically been in a position that would be viewed as full-time, and for the convenience of the employer makes the decision to put that employee into a job classification as part-time when historically it has been full-time, if the business is audited, the auditing entity may disallow that individual, you know, from being classified as a part-time employee, and then that would work against the 95% substantially all threshold that employers have to abide by. And so
when companies try to or might try to manipulate what the job is or manipulate the job rules – to try to get around it, it just doesn't sound worthwhile.
It's not good advice. Our advice is certainly not to do that, because if we become too fancy in the way that we want to classify employees, there's a good chance that we're probably going to run into a problem with that. And so that would not be good advice, you know, for an employer to take the chance on doing that type of.
It's funny. Obviously, at CMA, we do compensation analysis, and we look at all this, and we do say the reality is it's always best to be upfront. Always best to be upfront and just classify it the way it should be. Let's make the rules and regulations around it. Let's look at it. Because, look, you're trying to attract talent anyway. And why would you want to make it an odd situation and have a harder time getting talent to put them in a box that doesn't fit?
Yeah, precisely. And so if we're going to let's err on the side of being in compliance and not being on the side of not being in compliance. Because, once again, the penalties are just too severe to take that risk. So the substantially all threshold is one provision of the law that's vitally important to be clear and totally understand exactly what that means. And so we're really talking about, you know, offering coverage to those employees that are 30 or more hours. And the documentation also is an important component of all that, making sure that, if you have a question, that you can pull out the documentation to demonstrate that the coverage was offered.
So when an employer is looking at this compliance in terms of documentation, is there any feel or understanding right now how long this is going to take? Are there some companies that are looking at it's going to take 15 hours to do all this documentation. Is there any feel yet in terms of how long it will take an employer to do this type of work?
That's a good question. I don't think we've not done the analysis to really come up with that standard. However, I think it's safe to say that if an employer is using a manual homegrown system, that there's probably going to be a lot more hours involved doing it that way, as opposed to working with organizations that have the technology and the systems in place to be able to automate some of this process. If you're looking at a business with 300 or 400 employees, the magnitude of that work would be overwhelming. To be able to track all employees that you've had over the course of the year, and to define specifically, what their work status was, when they were employed by you, it would be overwhelming. I think using a homegrown manual system is probably not a good idea.
Yeah, I think I liken this a little bit to affirmative action plans. If you're a federal compliance organization and you have to, track everything within the organization in terms of affirmative action, race, gender, all that sort of stuff, and it's got to be held very carefully and put in a safe place and all that sort of stuff. And to do that manually, and there are some organizations that still do, but it takes forever. And it is much easier if you can have a trusted partner that you can use that can automate all this for you in terms of making it easier for you to actually get the information. And think of how much money you're going to save in terms of time. Right, in terms of it. It does cost you on the front end, but it's a little bit better on the back end.
Yeah, and there's a training component to all of this. So, we have clients that have, we have not-for-profit clients that have multiple locations. And so there are multiple managers involved with running the business. And so training, for example, the managers to be, very, very precise on the tracking of the individual's time becomes a very, very important consideration for businesses like that. So businesses of that nature, I think, have an added burden of making certain that they can go back and reconstruct exactly what the workday was for each one of those employees.
We've talked about the large group. Let's just talk about success in the small group. What are some of the areas that you need to make sure you're taking care of right away if you're a small group?
Well, I think in the small group market, things have sort of been taken care of for you, because one of the provisions of law was really for the feds and the states to define the products that would be made available to individual and small group buyers. And so in terms of any product that you're purchasing from an insurance company, there's a good chance that those plans are already in compliance with the ACA, because the insurance industry has basically had to walk away from all of the old plans, and the only plans that can now be offered, to individuals and small businesses are ACA compliant health plans. And the rest, basically, there are four levels of coverage. There's the bronze, silver, gold, and platinum plans. And so unless you're in either a grandfathered or a grandmothered situation, and what I'm referring to there are old plans that were allowed to continue for a period of time, Then you're very likely in an ACA compatible plan, and so from the standpoint of compliance, it becomes a little bit easier. In the large group market, the coverage requirements are basically that that the plan provide minimum value, and the minimum value definition is for minimum essential benefits. The plan has to cover at least 60% of the costs associated with those services. And once again, I think the insurance industry has been very, very helpful in making certain that they offer plans that are in compliance. It becomes a little bit more of a challenge for businesses that self-insure to make sure that their plans are in compliance with the spirit of the ACA.
So, simple question, hoping a simple answer. The number one thing an employer should think about when they're thinking about the ACA today is what?
Well, once again, for those applicable large employers, is offering coverage to substantially all of their full-time employees. The other aspects of compliance with regard to plan design, there are people watching out for that. So the insurance industry is watching out for that. In the case of self-funded plans, oftentimes administrators are kind of watching out for that. But what's beyond the ability of the insurance industry, and in some cases even the ability of brokers that are working with businesses, is really knowing the status of all employees that are employed by that company. And then I would just add one other thing that we spoke earlier about commonly owned businesses or business aggregation rules. This is something that your retirement plans have had to deal with for quite some time. And so now that aspect of the of compliance, is extending down to the health insurance program. And so that's probably a secondary item that needs to be looked at, in those cases where there are multiple businesses.
We're talking with Mike DeShane. He is the president of Cross Insurance Employee Benefits. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today, we've been talking with Mike DeShane, president of Cross Insurance's Employee Benefits. You know, Michael, we've talked about a lot of things of where people are today. We've talked about large markets, small markets, group markets, ratings, ACA rules. But we're not done, are we? We have a future ahead of us. And so I want you to bring out that crystal ball and tell me what we have to look forward to in 2016 and beyond.
There is more to come.
Oh, how lucky we are. No, so let's talk about that.
Well, once again, the law was passed in 2010. And at least at the outset, what was defined was a rollout that would go at least until 2018. And the 2018 rollout is really the establishment of the Cadillac tax. And the Cadillac tax basically is a surcharge on plans that exceed a certain threshold. And so when the law was passed in 2010, the threshold for an individual plan was $10,200, and for a family was $27,500. That's when the law was changed. But medical inflation, keeps plugging away, and so the regulations are not out on this Cadillac tax, and so we don't know exactly what the thresholds will be. But whatever the thresholds are, any amounts above these thresholds would be assessed a 40% tax or surcharge. And so the question is, who pays for it? Does the employee pay for it? Does the employer pay for it? I think an important consideration with regard to the Cadillac tax are collective bargaining contracts. And so we're currently in a situation of where some of these union contracts are being negotiated, and that will reach out to 2018. And I'm not certain how many of these negotiations are taking this into consideration. And so that goes back to the question of who's going to pay for it. So certainly that's one issue that we know is coming down the pike. We know it's 2018. And so it still remains to be seen, whether or not that will survive. There are people that are betting that it won't, but we don't know. In addition to the Cadillac tax, we're looking at automatic enrollment. And what does that mean? So what that means is that for businesses with greater than 250 employees, I'm sorry, let me correct that, 200 employees, businesses need to auto-enroll the employees. So what that means is when somebody's hired, their application will be completed automatically. And so they'll be covered unless they take affirmative action to opt out of coverage. So that's a requirement. We're still waiting for the regulations to be issued on that. And this is a part of the law that actually was to go into effect shortly after the law was passed in 2010. Similarly, there's a non-discrimination aspect of the law that will prohibit employers from discriminating in favor of highly compensated employees. And this is very similar to what's being done today with retirement plans, 401k plans, and this sort of thing. And so this will extend to health insurance. But the important thing to keep in mind here is that the requirement is already in place for self-funded plans. And so if your plan is self-funded, you're already governed by these non-discrimination rules. And so what they're looking to do is to move the non-discrimination treatment of health insurance into the fully insured world of health insurance.
There's a lot to look forward to. So, you know, how long have you been doing this, Michael?
Do I need to answer that question?
Yes.
I started in the business in 1975.
And so you've been doing this for 10 years. Does that make you feel better? All right.
That sounds good.
Okay, I thought so. Yeah. What keeps you in the industry? All this change. I know a lot of people who have thought to themselves, wow, this is a lot. So what keeps you passionate about it?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I've actually thought about that on a few occasions. My training is an accountant. And so I really wanted to bring excitement into my life. And so
yes, okay.
So I moved over to insurance, health insurance. And actually, it's a difficult business. It's not an easy business. There's a lot of emotion associated with health insurance. When somebody has a serious medical condition and they're dealing with having to pay for that medical condition in some fashion, it's no wonder that there's a lot of emotion. And so we do help people. We help people, and I really, if I have to really boil it down, I think that's the answer. That somebody needs to do this, and I'm proud that I've made the decision to stay in this field and do this for as long as I have.
Well, it's been a great conversation today, Michael. Thank you for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. This is a lot of fun.
Great. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and here's your HR tip of the week. Good hiring decisions are critically important, as if you didn't know that. And this is on trendhr.com. Here are some of the reasons that good hiring decisions are critical to an organization's success. First, there are legal risks involved in making hasty hiring decisions. Second, the costs of hiring add up quickly. Third, good hires become productive faster. Fourth, employee morale is damaged when bad employees are hired. Fifth, a bad hire can mean the organization loses business. Sixth, bad hires increase stress. Seventh, if they don't fit, you'll have to bag them. And seventh, fixing a hiring mistake costs real resources. So get it right, and that's your tip on the HR Power Hour. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Deborah Weiss Ford, managing shareholder at Jackson Lewis Law Firm, is going to be talking about an interesting topic, fearless firing. Yes, it takes really good communication and strong documentation to make you fearless when it has to be a separation of employment. So listen to Deborah talk about these issues and more on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.